When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm your host, Elise Glink, and I'm here to help you make super smart decisions about your financial life. But first, Glinkonomics. So I've been thinking a lot about home sales numbers, and I've been doing a bit of traveling this summer. So you'll hear me talk a little bit about this in my interview this week with Jonathan Smoke, who's the chief economist at Realtor.com. But this summer I have been to San Francisco, which is ranked the hottest housing market in the country on so many levels. But I've also been to Columbus, and I was amazed to see in Columbus how things have really developed in the downtown. My opinion of Columbus has completely shifted. We were downtown at the convention center, and I took a long walk. It was 4th of July, and I was amazed as I was walking on the main drag towards Germantown, all of the interesting and unusual and vibrant shops and restaurants and technology that's going on there. Really interesting. It's almost like Columbus is so many, I'll call them the smaller of the top 50 or top 100 housing markets in the country, has started to percolate in new and interesting ways. I've also been out in New York and down in Atlanta. I'm going to be in Boston this week, well, next week, and I was there earlier this summer. And so where I am going, one of the things that I've really noticed is how technology and tech jobs have really taken hold. And people, more and more people, it's not just because the millennials are coming in. It's also people who are in their late 30s and 40s, more of the Gen Xers or the Gen Ys, who have started to rethink their business propositions, are demanding new and different services, and are asking companies and businesses to respond to them. It's fascinating. What that's doing is trickling down into just a whole new kind of lifestyle, really, that is very different from generations in the past. And so I think that this is starting to really go, well, it will, over the next 10 or 20 years, work incredible magic in the economy. And now we're just starting to take little baby steps. But what we're not seeing is an economy that's been rebounding in a very traditional way. And Jonathan Smoke and I talk about this, you'll hear a little bit more about it. But this idea that this recession, this great recession that we had back in 2007, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, for some people, it's still going on, and you've heard me say that before, the Great Recession has not had a normal recovery. And the last recession, back in 2000 and 2001, we referred to that one as a jobless recovery. It was also anything but a normal recovery. And then suddenly we had an explosion of finance-driven, housing-driven, you know, economic boom, right? And then that bubble just absolutely burst. So if you think about the last 15 years of the economy, it's been anything but normal. And now when you get to 20 years, you're at an official generation. So when we get another 5 years, where are we really going to be? And what are we building to as we go on down the pike? So you might argue that the Great Recession was housing driven, right? Because we were building a bubble of mortgages and people were buying things they really couldn't afford to pay back. Now we have the, you know, afford that you have to be able to afford it to pay back kind of a rule that's been built into the borrowing decision. But I think about it and I'm just wondering how the next 5 years are going to pull us to where they're going to go. How is that all going to change? Are we really going to continue to build up speed? And my big question about the economy is we're pretty long in the tooth for a recovery. Typically by this time, we would have started to see a drag on the economy somewhere. We're seeing it in Europe and Asia, particularly China, It's taken a huge hit and very much in bear territory with its stock market. What's going to happen here? And my sense of it is, as long as the United States is the best place to put your money or the safest place to put your money, the Fed isn't going to be able to raise interest rates. That's going to stay low. People are going to put their money here because they'd rather have their money back in whole, 100% of it, than lose money by putting money away in Europe or somewhere else. So we're at an interesting place. Jonathan's pretty positive about it, and I'm engaged enough to wonder, you know, we're going to be fine, right? What's going to happen after the next 2 years? So more on that in the next few weeks. So officially, my guest this week is Jonathan Smoke, chief economist at Realtor.com. He is a wonderful person to talk to, and we went a little bit long with this, so I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. And he's been doing some parsing of the June home sales numbers, and those have showed some mixed trends in the housing market. So as I've said, I'm a little unsure myself about the current status of the housing market recovery. New construction, you know, the numbers look good, right? We might be at 500,000 new homes sold this year. Even Jonathan thinks we should be at about 800,000. I think we should be at 1 million. So I'm excited to talk to Jonathan, and we had this amazing conversation about what's happening. He's also got numbers on the hottest housing markets and the easiest markets in which to buy a house in July. We'll discuss those as well. Next week, you'll be seeing a lot of him on popular media as he goes around and talks about some of the new numbers that they're looking at for home sales. Then I'm going to answer a question from a landlord whose tenant broke his lease and moved out early, leaving some damage behind. The question is, what rights does the landlord have to confiscate the tenant's security deposit? And I'm going to break that down for you. And for a last treat, I've got some advice on how to lower your property tax bill. Challenging your property tax assessment can be super time intensive, but it could pay big dividends if you're successful because you'll see yourself saving on an annualized basis going forward. In other words, if you get them to lower your taxes, the next time they raise it, it's on the lower number. Okay, that's today's lineup. Let's get started. Early summer home sales reports have been kind of a mixed bag, and I've been hearing some anxiety from people who are wondering whether the housing market recovery is actually going to stall out before ever reaching its stride or before getting back to where it was 10 years ago. And I'll be honest, I've been a little concerned myself. But my guest today doesn't seem too worried. Jonathan Smoke is the chief economist for Realtor.com, and he recently published an article in which he explains why the new low sales numbers from, or I should say the low new home sales numbers from the Commerce Department shouldn't really be much of a cause for concern. Now, Realtor.com also has a couple of new reports out on the 20 hottest housing markets and the 10 housing markets where it's easiest to buy a home around the country. So we're going to get the scoop on that as well from Jonathan. Jonathan, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Glad to be with you, Elise.
It's really nice to meet you and have you on the show. We got to know each other a little bit at the recent National Association of Real Estate Editors Conference in Miami. It was the first time I'd ever really heard you talk, and I thought you lit up the room.
Well, thank you. I'm a longtime fan of yours. I lived in Atlanta for 17 years, so I used to enjoy you on WSB, and I think our careers focusing on real estate have actually pretty much overlapped over the last 20 years or so.
I think so, and I can't believe I never had you on that show. So I'm making up for lost time. We'll do a double-length interview today. We'll just spend the rest of the afternoon here talking. I'm sure we probably can. So let's go to some of these new sales numbers. It looks like the month over months for new construction sales are up. They were down in June, but they were way up in May. What's your take on what's really going on with new construction?
Yeah, the new construction data series, I just wrote a piece on Realtor.com last week about trying to make sense of some of these numbers that come out on a monthly basis that can be pretty confusing. When it comes to the new construction data, both the new home sales numbers that you were referring to and the permits and starts data, both of those are produced by the Commerce Department and they're based on surveys. In the case of new home sales, the Commerce Department surveys what is a relatively small sample of builders each month. And as the new home market is now a much smaller market than it once was, that type of approach to producing the data is very prone to having revisions. And in fact, having what is referred to statistically as a confidence interval that is very large, which if you read the fine print in the report, it essentially meant that that 7% down figure was not statistically significant. In other words, the headline should have been, we really have no clue how June compared to May, which always leads me to really dig into what numbers can we really rely on. And so, for example, in that case, I pay attention to the non-seasonal numbers for each month so far this year. Interestingly, they also, as another kind of shout out to how noisy that series can be, they revised every number, every monthly number going back to March. In the release that we received last week. So when you look at the year-to-date numbers, new home sales are actually up 20% over last year. And that's way more consistent with other data points that we're seeing. So for example, NAHB puts out a monthly builder sentiment index, and that's pretty much been at the highest levels it has been in nearly a decade. So seeing really strong sales would certainly make more sense in that light. And then national public builders have been reporting, of course, their quarterly earnings, and the news coming from them from a new orders perspective has been generally very positive.
But let me jump in, because it strikes me that, yes, the numbers are all looking really good, and sort of this year-over-year 20% increase is wonderful. But last year, we were still under 500,000 new homes sold, which is probably less than half of where we should be. We're now 8 years, or 6 years officially, past the bottom of the recession. From March of 2009, we saw that's where the stock market really went to the bottom. So we might be over 500,000 new homes sold, but wouldn't you agree that we really, by this point in time particularly, should be over 1 million new homes sold a year?
We should at least probably be in the territory of 800,000 and trending towards 1 million if it were a typical recovery, and if the industry looked more like it historically has. But that's the issue. This hasn't been a normal recovery. This was a housing-induced recession that largely was a reflection of overbuilding and the industry itself, the home building industry. It looks incredibly different today than it did a decade ago. You have the share of new home sales that's controlled by the largest builders. Has grown over the years as their access to capital, especially for small, local, and regional builders, has evaporated.
Well, they've also bought each other up, right? You've got a situation where I think it was Pulte merging with, who did they merge with at the bottom of the recession? The other really huge deal. Do you remember who it was?
You had Del Webb during the peak that Pulte bought. Mm-hmm. You had multiple purchases and mergers. I myself was a part of a national builder that we went through huge growth in acquisitions.
Yeah.
So there's no question. And the stat that Metro Study, a company that I used to work with, actually reported that in 2014, over 60% of the closings nationally for new homes last year was controlled by the 200 largest builders in the country.
Right.
And that is phenomenal change in the structure of the business. And those larger builders are very disciplined. Most of the large ones are public, either publicly traded or they have public debt.
Yeah.
And as a result, they've been very much focused on profitability and smart growth. So you haven't seen the typical type of 40 to 50% increase in permits and starts so far. And I'm really skeptical that we ever will over the next several years, at least.
So let me go back to something you said about this recession being the recovery being anything but normal. Let's go back to the prior recession. So 1999, 2000, 2001. And I'm sort of including 1999. It wasn't the recession then. That was still sort of the big expansion going to the pop. But, you know, we did not see a normal recovery from that either. That was considered the first jobless recovery. And we talked about how this is really a housing-driven recession. I would argue that the growth was really financial services-based growth, where you were seeing the kind of ginning up of the money, super low interest rates, you know, that had started back in 1993 when interest rates fell for mortgages below 6% for the first time. maybe since World War II. And so you saw in 2001 when you started to have this big pop sort of from the West Coast. You had a lot of digital stuff. This is the early years of Google and all these other companies that said, we don't need to make money. We can just, I don't know what, live on air. But you saw that jobless recovery in the aughts, as it's called. And then we started with the building up of this housing bubble. And then we had the explosion of the housing bubble. And so now, since really 2001, in my view, and I'm only the armchair economist. You're the one with all the letters after your name. But wouldn't you agree that these two recessions back to back and the jobless recoveries have really driven a systematic change in the way that the economy works and how it's moving going forward?
Yes, I often refer to the fact that that really the last 15 years haven't exactly been normal by any stretch of the imagination. So that really causes problems when you're trying to forecast what's going to happen next and how is this going to evolve. The period that you described, had the popping of the tech bubble and really capital was still very loose. And real estate suddenly became the hot place to go. And you can see that in the federal funds data showing just how much debt ended up pouring into real estate, which of course led to the housing bubble and the enormous increase both in home prices and in sales that effectively, I like to tell people in the industry that we really should have a lobotomy and forget about the years 2004 to 2006, because we're likely never going to see that sort of activity again.
Well, I hope we don't, because the price that we have paid as a country and as a world, we're still paying it 8 years later. And you could certainly argue that now with the international issues that we're seeing, where you've got functionally negative interest rates in Europe, we've got China's stock market in well into bear territory. The country, the government's trying to prop that up. That doesn't seem to be working for many investors. So they're in a very serious situation. Latin America has slowed down. You know, you can argue that a lot of these problems around the world come from this kind of CDO marketplace that we established back in 04 to 06. And the visuality of it for, I think, most people was the fact that houses went up all over the place and people who had, you know, were making $50,000 a year were getting, you know, no doc loans for $500,000. And that was kind of how it all played out.
So that's right. You can see that in the financing numbers. You can see that also in that vacancies started to creep up as you had pretty rampant speculation leading to people who had, you know, short-term plans to flip homes. And the good news is we've finally unwound most of the problems that were created by that.
So just from a historical perspective, as an economist, does it make you worried that we're in the eighth year of a recovery? And shouldn't we be thinking about another recession at this point?
Yes and no. If you look at long-term trends and the definition that we've been in a recovery for 8 years, but as I mentioned before, this hasn't exactly been a normal recovery. And you can see that, you know, for example, I would argue that this is the first year that the housing market has been healthy since I've been pointing back to 2006, but you can argue that 2006 certainly wasn't healthy either.
No.
So I think some elements of the recovery are just now getting real and getting fundamental. And another way to kind of put it is that it's also the challenge that the Fed has been facing with regards to when is the appropriate time to come off of a zero interest rate policy. And that has been, it's been really what has been referred to as a Goldilocks type of recovery. Meaning we weren't ever getting hot. 3% is something that we're excited about these days.
And what does that say? 3% growth, and people are like putting up balloons.
That's right. And I think maybe 20 years from now, 10 years from now, we might have enough information to really realize that we're going through a major structural period where so many things were changing. Globalization has certainly impacted labor, and it's caused the U.S. labor to essentially have to be far more competitive, and as a result, wages and incomes haven't increased for quite some time. Technology went through a tremendous productivity cycle, and now it appears that productivity has slowed again. And then meanwhile, we've got these enormous demographic shifts occurring in the country, yeah. You know, such that virtually every developed country in the world is seeing only growth in one category of households, and that is households that are retired or over 55, over 65, or et cetera. So we're really going through a lot of fundamental changes that I think eventually will make sense when we have more data points to look at. But back to your original question about the recovery, at least from a housing perspective, I don't really see too many risks over at least the next year or two, which of course is where we have the most visibility, because again, it's fundamental health, the kind of factors that lead to price weakness or declines in the future are just not present. We really have fundamental health for the first time in a long time.
So the studies that you've just done for Realtor.com, top three hottest metros for July in terms of sales and probably price increases as well, you've got San Francisco, Denver, and Dallas. 11 of the 20 hottest markets are in California. I was just in San Francisco, and my son's friend, who's got a job out there for the summer, is making a ridiculous amount of money per month. He's working for a big hot tech company. They're paying like $8,000 a month. His rent, $7,000 a month. Now, he's got now four guys sharing that room, that two-bedroom, but the point is that it's still $7,000 a month for a tiny two-bedroom in San Francisco. You know, what is that saying about where we're going?
Well, so the story in California is very much what you just described. It's really been following phenomenal economic growth, and the nature of that economic growth, largely driven by the tech sector, has been producing significant increases in the number of high-income households. So just to frame it, the entire state of California, which of course is a could stand, I think, as the fifth largest economy in the world if it were independent. So there's quite a bit of variety. But over the last 15 years, California has had an increase of households to the tune of 14%. But yet the number of households that make over $200,000 a year has more than doubled over that period. So the nature of the growth they've experienced has essentially created demand for housing that can afford the kind of prices that are there, both on the rent side and the owning side. And at the same time, it's incredibly difficult to increase the housing stock in California. Land is extremely expensive, has been. Plus, the regulatory environment makes it one of the most difficult places in the country to entitle and develop land. And so as a result, you essentially have a housing shortage that by day is getting worse and worse, and the market responds to that with higher prices, and the households that are there increasingly are capable of paying those numbers. So it hasn't been a surprise. We've been ranking the markets every month this spring and summer, and the California markets have dominated the list because largely of the growth in the Silicon Valley and the Bay Area, but also now Southern California. And there's quite a bit of spillover effect. That's the word that I've used to describe it, because number one, you have the situation that households in Sacramento and places like Stockton are willing to commute more than an hour to be able to afford more of the home that they expected and wanted to live. And at the same time, you have an economic spillover effect that, you know, California is in a virtuous economic cycle, that the housing, what's going on in housing, both in new construction and home sales is supporting economic growth. And in turn, that's driving more demand for housing. So there's no question that California has great mojo. But as you pointed out, it's not just California. We've actually been watching San Francisco, Denver, and Dallas duke it out each month for which market is going to be the absolute hottest in the country with regards to how fast inventory is moving and how many eyeballs are looking at the listings each month.
Well, I have to just say, but some of your other top 20 lists, I was amazed. Ann Arbor, Michigan, from the University of Michigan. I was just there. Yes. My son is touring. Very interesting what's going on. A lot of things there that are very tech-driven out of the university that are starting to build their own kind of tech, science, medical communities. Just a lot of demand there. Detroit, we've seen property prices double from, like, say, $500 to well over $1,000 for that six-bedroom house. No, I'm just kidding. But you know what I mean. It's not... Detroit is coming back, and we've done stories ourselves for a bunch of our different outlets about how property was bought, you know, big, huge houses for, you know, maybe $10,000 or $18,000, and those same homes now are selling for $200,000. They've been fixed up, and the neighborhoods are starting to slowly, I want to say slowly, come back. Columbus was interesting. I was just in Columbus, and there's just a little bit of stuff happening downtown. It's really, really interesting. The neighborhoods, they have a real problem, though, with taxes and school districts. Austin, of course, university-driven, and then Los Angeles. Any surprises here to you?
Oh, I love that mix. I love seeing some Midwestern markets show up in the list. Austin, to me, is not so much as interesting as Detroit, Ann Arbor, and Columbus, because Austin is very much like, another Denver, another essentially... it's a story of the same thing going on in Northern California, if not driven by the ridiculousness of what's going on in Northern California.
Wait, I have to tell you a story about Columbus. So we're there for my son was playing in the volleyball nationals, and they were held in Columbus this summer. So we were just there over July 4th, and we were hanging out with a guy and his wife. This was my husband's best man at his wedding, a college friend. His wife's she works as a secretary at the local school district outside of Columbus, a nearby suburb, really fancy suburb. And she tells me that all of the teachers have taken second jobs as realtors, and they are selling real estate after school and at downtown, because the downtown of Columbus has gotten so hot with all these shops and the live near work kind of thing, that she said everybody there, they think they're going to be fired from their school teacher jobs because there's no money for schools because of tax reform. So they're all helping people buy and sell real estate.
Well, maybe that explains a little bit of the demand that we see. But, it's interesting, both Columbus and Detroit also made the list that we put out yesterday on the easiest places to buy in the country. So it's interesting to look at those two markets because they made both of our lists, the newest report that we put out yesterday on the easiest places to buy. And that's testament to the fact that when we did that list, we were not identifying, you know, the ultimate buyer's markets in the country from the perspective of unhealthy places. These are places that are still seeing inventory move faster than the national average and are also seeing price increases. But it represents that some of the demand that's going on is quite simply as people are looking for affordable places to own a home. And those markets are also places where you're seeing much larger numbers of millennials, the younger households, which we think are absolutely what's driving the real growth that we're seeing in housing this year over last year.
Well, let me just run down that list very quickly for everybody. Indianapolis is number one, easiest place to buy. Memphis, Virginia Beach, Birmingham, Alabama, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Atlanta, which is really interesting. You'd think everything had been bought there by now, but no. Cleveland, Detroit, again, Detroit to your point, and Columbus, Ohio, also to your point. All of that in the eastern half of the country and a little bit south. Not super far south. We're not seeing Florida. We're not seeing really Texas in there. But the eastern, kind of the eastern south, I don't know what you would call mid-Atlantic. What do we call that now?
Yeah. It's pretty much the Southeastern Conference.
Southeastern Conference. There you go. Just go to sports. When all else fails, there's a sports metaphor. Jonathan, we're going to put up links to all of these so people can read everything that you've written, but I would love to have you back. This was, as I thought, a really terrific conversation.
Yeah, anytime, Elise.
All right, thank you. Jonathan Smoke, Chief Economist for Realtor.com. I got the following question from a landlord whose tenants broke a lease. Here's the question. I rented my house for what should have been a year, but my tenants broke the agreement after 10 months. They have a $500 security deposit on file with me. So far, so good. After they moved out, I inspected the house and found a broken window, roaches, a damaged window screen, and I discovered that they'd never changed the furnace filter. They are now expecting a total refund to their $500 deposit, and I don't feel like I should pay for the damages that they caused. Who's right? The short answer is, you're right, in most cases. But the particulars of your situation mean you need to dig into the lease agreement that you use to see what it says about specific issues, like the security deposit and the terms under which you can either keep it or use it to fix broken items. Now, in most cases, a landlord can apply the security deposit toward the lost rent by caused by a tenant's early termination of the lease. Also, a tenant is responsible for returning the apartment to the landlord in about the same condition to which it was delivered, taking into account ordinary wear and tear. Now, most leases say the tenant is responsible for any damage caused to the unit during his or her occupancy. One way to make sure you know what condition the property was actually in would be to have a written checklist of the property, of the condition of the property, and have the tenant sign it to show that he or she agrees with the actual condition. Now, you can back up any issues with photographic or video evidence. And the way people tend to do that is they have a big chart or checklist, and they walk around and they check off everything with the tenant as they're moving into the unit, and then the tenant signs it. Most leases would provide that your tenants owe you at least the last 2 months of rent, along with payment for any damage they caused to your unit. Even if there wasn't any damage to the unit, leaving the apartment in filthy condition could be enough of a reason to deduct reasonable cleaning expenses from the security deposit to bring it back into the shape the apartment was when you leased it to them. You need to read your lease and determine what the lease says happens in this sort of situation. You might also want to consult with a local real estate attorney to determine what your losses are and whether you might need to demand additional payment from your tenants. You might not get it, but you might be able to demand it. You may decide to send them a demand letter for additional payment or even sue them for breaching the lease. And you should keep in mind that some leases provide for the reimbursement of attorney's fees in case you sue the tenant for default under the lease. In any case, small claims court works as well. Good luck. Be sure to let me know what happens. According to Zillow, the median U.S. property tax bill in 2013 was $2,100. Now, that was actually down by almost $700 from 2012. So it seems like many homeowners have already taken steps to lower their property taxes. Of course, the value has fallen through the floor in so many homes. But if you're a homeowner who has yet to contest your property tax assessment, here's a few tips for what to do when you decide to do that. First, you might want to fact check your property information. Get your property card, also known as working papers or a worksheet, from your local tax assessor's office. It should outline how they determine your home's assessed value by including information such as square footage, lot size, the number of bathrooms, bedrooms, whatever. If that data is inaccurate, you may need to have your property reassessed, or at the very least, you'll want to correct the inaccuracies, especially if the assessor says you have 5 bedrooms when you really only have 3. While you're there, ask your local assessor how they assess the properties and how to go about appealing that assessed valuation. There's going to be a specific time period. We'll talk about that in a moment. Now, next, you want to determine if your home is actually overvalued compared to what's going on in the market. To see if your property is properly assessed, you need to look online at the tax classification and then find a half a dozen comparable homes that recently sold using information from your assessor or from a listing site. Now, it shouldn't be the listing price, it should be the sold price. If your home is valued at 5 to 10% higher than those properties, that may be grounds for an appeal. Remember that counties typically assess homes on a 1 to 3 year cycle, so the value may not be up to date. Next, present your case. Once you've gathered up the information, try to meet with the assessor or one of the assessor's representatives at the office. And if he or she won't meet with you or won't adjust your assessment, you can file a formal appeal. In fact, you can keep filing appeals all the way up to, I think, the state Supreme Court, if not beyond. Now, while the process differs from place to place, you should be prepared to submit your appeal in writing along with the evidence that your property should be reassessed. You should receive an answer within a few weeks. And again, there's some very specific timetables about when you can file the initial appeal and then the appeal of the appeal, the appeal of the appeal of the appeal, and so on. As you can imagine, this is a long and laborious process, but it's probably worthwhile when it could save you hundreds or even thousands of dollars a year. And this is the gift that keeps on giving, right? Because once you lower the assessment, future increases are built off that lower price. If you've got a question about buying real estate, you can send it to me at questions@thinklink.com or via Twitter @Glink. I really hope you enjoyed today's episode, and I want to thank Jonathan, Chief Economist for Realtor.com, again for being on the show. And if there was anything you missed, don't forget to check out the show notes to this episode at thinklink.com, thinkglink.com. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes if you haven't already, and give us a rating or a review while you're there. I mean, come on, this is the sharing society. Share your opinion by searching for the Elise Glink Show in the podcast section of iTunes. And then you can check out my Monday Morning Marketing podcast with Elise Glink and John Byrne, which is also available on iTunes. It's free. It's for anyone who wants some extra marketing, PR, social media advice. John and I laugh a lot. He's an award-winning former chief marketing officer for a global law firm and an attorney and a former journalist. And as you know, he likes to cook. He's got triplets. He's cool. And as you all know, I run a digital content agency called ThinkLink Media, where we help companies find solutions to all sorts of communication problems. You can find us online at thinklinkmedia.com. Whew! That is the end of another episode of the Elise Glink Show. Super exciting for me. Hope you enjoyed it. I'm your host, Elise Glink. I'll be back next week with another new episode. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week.